Welcome, everyone. Today we are going to be discussing another chapter in Pathways to Pain Relief. This one is called The Legacy of Harsh Parenting. It is about Mr. L and the Tenacious Inner Critic. We are just sharing our own experiences. This is a book group. It is not intended to treat or diagnose any medical condition. So if you need medical advice, make sure you get it from a doctor. Today, Eric, a.k.a. Herbie, is going to be facilitating, and Bruce will be presenting an introduction to the topic. As the tech support guy, I'm going to start things up, but then I'm just basically going to hand it off and let you folks go to town. If anyone has any questions at any time, of course, just chime right in. Bruce.
Well, as Forrest already said, today we're going to be dealing with a section of Sherman and Anderson's Pathways of Pain Relief that appears under the title Mr. L and the Tenacious Inner Critic, which is a subtitle of a section called The Legacy of Harsh Parenting. Mr. L, Dr. Anderson's patient, was 64, and he'd shed the back brace he had worn every day for 25 years after Dr. Sarno had diagnosed him as having TMS. And he'd worn this back brace every day for 20 years, and he'd had back surgery. Mr. L had had back surgery 20 years before to repair a herniated disc. He recovered from the surgery and he adopted a very active life. He was very successful in business, and yet he'd worn the corset all these years for fear, terrified that he would re-injure himself without it. So he began individual psychotherapy on a once-a-week basis with Dr. Anderson 5 months after receiving a TMS diagnosis from Dr. Sarno in October 2006. One of the first sessions Mr. L had with Dr. Anderson established the tenor. The underlying symbolic content behind emotional symbolic content behind his behavior and his TMS back pain, and it came out that his father, who had died in 1993, had informed him at age 18 that his father was a bigamist. And you notice that Mr. L banished his father from his life, and he did not speak to him for 25 to 30 years before he died. And during the first half year of therapy, he told Dr. Anderson about how competitive he had been with his father. And this quote stands out. His father consistently, ruthlessly, made him feel like a failure if he noticed him, or like he didn't exist at all. As I listened, Dr. Anderson listened, I could easily sense the impact of his father's narcissism on Mr. L's self-esteem. Let's see, I've shifted the page here. And there was a 4-week break, and during which time I think she was on vacation, he was on vacation, then she was sick, and then they had a breakthrough session, and because she during which time she wanted to help him hear how harsh and critical he can be toward himself when he doesn't measure up to his own very high standards. If Mr. L gave you details about his track record, You would be astounded to hear him call himself a failure in life. Further, he calls himself stupid because he feels like a failure. And yet, his very demeanor contradicts the image he has of himself, that Mr. L has of himself. He's just about to be 65. He's athletic, trim, dresses in an understated, youthful style. He has piercing blue eyes. He can dissect any topic, has a sarcastic sense of humor, and a resonant voice. Our interchanges are often fun because I enjoy his sense of humor, but he rarely laughs. Again, the flat affect that we're familiar with. He was intimidating, and he kept people at a distance. This was something that Dr. Anderson noticed. And yet, when Dr. Anderson made this observation about how he kept people at a distance and how he was intimidating, Mr. L was shocked. He had no idea what I was talking about. This was a, what do they call that? Insight and blankness and insight. You know, this was the blank area. This was what he hadn't examined.
Tell us a little bit more about blankness and insight. I'm not familiar with that idea.
Oh, that's Paul Damon, the French philosopher. Blindness and Insight, that's his famous essay. And he talks about how it's what you don't see and what you don't hear that what a psychoanalytic conscious modern consciousness can find beneath the surface. It's what you overlook. It's what you don't state. The insight is founded on the negativity underneath it. It's very existential, as you might imagine. Paul Lamont's an existential philosopher, New Wave philosopher. He just died a while ago. He's very influential. He talks about how modern artists are always unhappy because they can never create something that's real like nature. So they're always longing to create a poem that's going to be a thing.
Taking it to TMS, it does kind of remind me about how for kind of alexithymia, which is a common thing in TMS, not being able to connect with one's emotions is what alexithymia means, is we just don't know about the emotions. We just aren't aware of them. Or I guess that's maybe even in the nature of repression.
Yes, you know, that's Dr. the word that occurred to me.
Okay.
That's the first thing I thought about was repression. Blindness and Insight, that's the name of his essay. Yeah, it's the things that you're blind to that create those moments of connectedness where you do have insight. The insight is founded on what you don't know. Well, there we go, the divided mind, you know, the conscious and the unconscious mind. Dr. Anderson tries to increase Mr. L's awareness of the ways in which he had unconsciously adopted his father's harsh parenting attitude toward himself. In doing so, he constantly was creating more unconscious rage at being treated badly by himself. And that's why, after many years, the reservoir of rage, to borrow Dr. Sarno's term, had began to overflow, and he had TMS symptoms. And I believe at the end of the story, the end of the session, Mr. L has the insight that I don't have to be in a battle with myself, that I can allow myself to be more satisfied with myself, and that seems to, in some way, keep the reservoir of rage from overflowing as often as it used to. So he had a moment of insight, didn't he? He wasn't blind anymore. And that's what resolved the tension between the inner and the outer mind, between the conscious and the unconscious mind, and solved his TMS dilemma. So, to make a long story short, that's the story of Mr. L.
Were you going to say something, Eric? Did I just hear your voice?
This is like, you know, complete awareness. This is like the first time that I understood TMS. And I'm sitting there washing dishes. And while I'm washing the dishes, I got this this inner critic going on in my head saying, well, you should have done this and you should have done that. And then, you know, the id and the superego is up there arguing. And I'm judging myself. And I caught it, you know, and I caught it. And I'm like, what's going on here, you know, because and I hear a lot of that in the story. But it was also something that first happened when I first started learning about TMS. It was the awareness of that you know, let me know that there was a lot more going on inside my head than just, you know, me thinking for myself all the time consciously, you know?
Well, I think Mr. L has a moment of insight when he, I think that's on section, location 2364. It's when Dr. Anderson reminds him, and he recalls, Mr. L recalls that we had discussed that he treats himself the way his father treated him. So he's always under his father's harsh judgment, and then he's behaving that way himself, unconsciously. That accounts for his intimidating manner to others that he's not aware of, the blindness again.
And he'd always feel better like when he went on a vacation, and then he'd come back, and I guess it was like the stressors that was back at home or work or whatever he was doing, it would bring
him back
home.
It was Manhattan. When he was in Manhattan, he had to work, and yet he was retired. And he was approaching retirement or had retired, and he had a lot of interest in Manhattan, but Manhattan signaled accomplishment. He was still under his father's dictatorship there.
Yeah. His,
but when he would go away on vacation, then he could just be himself. And he went asymptomatic then. But back in Manhattan, the work switch went on.
The inner critic came out again.
He was back with Dad.
Oh.
This was the arena, I guess, where he'd worked this stuff out for years, being the perfect businessman.
He was, and also when the inner critic came out, the pain would come on, correct? I mean, that's the way the story went, right?
Yeah, I think so.
More of it. He would actually be in less pain on vacation and more pain when he came back to Manhattan.
But I think it's because he wasn't conscious of it, too.
Correct.
That's when it exercised its sway over him. Once he had a moment of insight, then it lost its hold on him. This new knowledge short-circuited that process.
Was you going to say something for us?
Thank you. I was just going to ask if I could have the floor since you're facilitating today.
Mm-hmm.
I was going to say, I liked how she used the term rage, and often the word tension is very natural to me. Like you can feel, like when I think about Mr. L, I think of tension. Dr. Anderson used the term rage, and I thought that was a good way to understand how rage works in TMS, in that it is enraging to be so hard on yourself. I think that's an easy sentiment to relate to, how, you know, he had this inner voice yelling at him, and it enraged him. It reminds me a lot of Alan Gordon's Inner Bully.
Inner Bully. Yes. I remember when I was just in my teenage years, and all the times that, like, say the teacher would say something or catch me doing something wrong, and I would have this, I guess by then, maybe it was the id then, and it was just tearing me up and just making me feel like, you know, nothing. But, you know, there I am washing the dishes one day at 38 years old, and I catch it. So, you know, whether it's the id or the superego, some people call it the ego, all three of them, a lot of us don't know it's there, this inner critic. A lot of us don't know it's there until we, you know, hear something like what we're speaking about right now and stumble upon it, stumble across it. And little do we know, getting this inner critic calmed down, you know, through meditations or whatever it might be, is a way to stop pain in our bodies. It's amazing. It's a miracle.
So how does one quiet down the inner critic or become aware of the inner critic?
I think Dr. Sarno tells us to tell it to shut up, you know, and
yeah.
Yeah. I mean, others, like Steve-O, he'll just tell it to calmly, you know, calm down and hush real nice. I guess it's according if it's the superego or if it's the id. Yeah, I guess you want to baby the id like Kate was doing last week. And the superego, the parent part, I don't know. I just kind of tell mine, told mine to be calm so much that I hardly ever get the inner critic anymore. And when I say that I hardly ever get it anymore, I'm talking about just recently, within the last month, have I not heard the inner critic within like a month. So it took a long time of working with it through different variations to get it to, so I can know it's all me. It's just all me. It's all one brain there. At the same time, I still got the parent up there, and I still got the id going on. Oh, what about y'all? I mean, this is what it's all about, the inner critic, right?
Right.
So,
Eric, I saw a string on the TMS forum that you were involved in, a string that involved, I believe, a post by Steve-O to start with.
Yeah.
And one quote in there that struck me in light of Mr. L's experience was what Steve said. He said the most common survival mechanism behind TMS is the non-expression, the internalization of anger, along with deeper aspects of the self. Once it is learned early on to never talk back, never yell, never get angry, never show any emotion, and the person survived that day, Steve calls it escaping the lion, that method is the method for life. But this can change, and this is great news.
Wow.
And I think you said something about similar to that afterwards. And that resonates with my reading of this section.
Mm-hmm.
In Anderson and Sherman, Mr. L has never examined this. He just adopted that strategy of the blank affect, but yet his rage comes out. You see it in his demeanor, in those steely eyes staring ahead. He must have been very mad at his dad.
Yeah.
As he listened to this litany of his own lack of self-worth. And then he's going, well, see, what in the heck did you do, Dad? You were a bigamist. What were you to lecture me? And he probably never articulated that. He just edited it out of his life. He just never talked to him for 25 years.
Yeah, and did anybody else want to say anything about the inner critic? I see we got, okay, Forrest, you still here?
I am,
okay?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me?
Okay, okay, we got it going. Okay, what you were saying there, Bruce, his father, you know, he said his father made him feel like a failure. If he even noticed him at all, you know, and if you even noticed that he existed as he was growing up. So could you assume, you know, how that would make a child think in their mind, and then the way you would grow up and sort of have this not only inner critic, I'm a failure, you know, I'm no good, you know, look at, this is what Dad thinks about me, and how much chatter would be going on just from that alone, of thinking that you're your dad, who you look up to, just thinks you're no good. And this can go over into so many areas, you know. And then you go to work, and then your boss, you know, looks at you the way maybe your dad did one day.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden,
mm-hmm.
you're thinking your boss is thinking that you're a failure, you know.
In my own personal experience, I remember being in an important contract with the International Standards Organization
uh-huh.
and making a lot of money for a year or over a year and being praised inordinately by my hiring manager. Well, one day they fire 1,400 people and my hiring manager, and, of course, everything is shaken up at work. And out of the blue comes this little man who walks up to me and starts saying, "It's your fault. You did it.
Yeah.
It's all because of you that this whole thing happened." Now, mm-hmm. you know, and then he would follow me around and criticize me, trying to get me to leave. But I explained to him that I'm under contract with the agency and I have to keep coming
mm-hmm.
Into work. But he would follow me and dutifully insult me and then have me in for private meetings where he'd browbeat me. And one day I had the epiphany. I realized the reason I was taking this was because this guy's criticism reminded me of what my dad did to me.
Correct.
And then I saw through the charade. I saw through the facade. I realized that every time I'd had a boss who criticized me and I took it, it was really the same as sitting next to dad while he browbeat me and told me I was worthless. And that's why I would take it. I learned that.
Yeah, and to find that out and know that that's what's happening, that just gave you a new power. That just you just was able to grab a hold of something that had basically been beating you up for your whole life. And now you can turn back around and control it. And that's an awesome part of this story about the inner critic is that we can get the inner critic under control somewhat to a degree.
The irony is, though, this is the kicker. If
uh-huh.
I had just told the guy to shove it and walked out the door,
uh-huh.
letting him lead it into human resources and get me booted, I would have been called back by another hiring manager who got the assignment 2 months later and would have been right back in there making money. But because I adopted the strategy that I had with my father, the dysfunctional strategy of taking it and suffering, therefore I was banned from the place and couldn't come back. And it just shows how you learn these inappropriate behavior patterns when you're a child. These immature behavior patterns that you've adapted to deal with superego figures, and they're not always real. They're not always the most efficient ways of going about things.
Correct. You know, my superego
self-defeating.
Yeah, I think that what I'm learning out of all of this, both today and just different things I've been doing for the last few months, is that it's really a management problem. It's not like you could do without the inner critic because, you know, I mean, I think we all know a few people who could, they may be paralyzed by their inner critic, but
it's a guidance system.
Need one that's participating in their life. I think what we have to do is we just have to become rational beings. You know, we have to say no. You know, obviously now we need some fun, and let's not overdo it. You know, let's be sensible. Let's remember our standards, but let's let go for a while. You know, I mean, I think we're a very complex creatures, people, and we're never, ever, I think the thing that I have to get through my head as I don't know where I got it from, that you can be perfect. Maybe that did come from my parents. I wouldn't be surprised. They were, you know, massively imperfect, but somehow I was supposed to be perfect. So I figured that one out when I was about 8 years old. No, this is not working. But somehow there's some residual thing there, is that I'm supposed to figure this all out so that I just behave in a perfect manner. You know, I know what to do in every given situation. I don't ever make a fool of myself. I don't ever, insult somebody either inadvertently or on purpose. You know, I do. I follow all the rules, right?
Yes, prim.
Completely impossible. And B, goodness sake, you know, I mean, why would you want a life like that? So that's what I'm working on here, is just getting to know all these characters and trying to be a good manager for myself.
It's very interesting the way that you talk about the characters and how the different characters come up. It reminds me of, you've kind of been teaching us on the forum about internal family systems. And so we were talking about how to handle the bully, the internal critic. And it reminded me, I listened to one of those links that you shared with us from YouTube, and he talked about, the founder of IFS talked about just asking the internal critic to step back. So he said that if you yell at the internal critic, then that almost empowers the internal critic. It gives them strength to fight back. Whereas if you just ask it to step back, and if it doesn't, you say, okay, why? What's protecting you? Then maybe you can ask that other thing to step back. I thought it was interesting about, you know.
Yeah, that's the gist of management, isn't it? Because if you're managing a group of people, sometimes people are going to come to work and they're having an off day and things are not great, and you can't just tell them they're stupid and to get out of your way. I mean, you have to manage people. And it's the same thing with ourselves. We have to be kind to ourselves, but we also have to require ourselves to live up to certain standards that we have decided that we want. I mean, for, you know, it's just like, what did somebody say? You don't have to keep up with the Joneses, but you shouldn't move, you shouldn't fall back with the Kulikaks, you know, sort of thing. We all have to decide where we stand in life, and we have to try and orchestrate that into a life. And of course, obviously, a baby doesn't know any of this stuff, and they learn some wrong things. They have to spend the rest of their lives unlearning. But that's what life is all about.
So I love what you're saying. It is. It's a great conversation.
I like the management system she's got going there. That is managing the inner critic. That is awesome. I've never heard that.
Mine seems to have an independent life of its own, though. It's like when I'm not achieving or I'm not getting something done and I'm facing existential isolation or whatever, then the internal critic will come bouncing up into my head and start this argument. And it's under different masks. Sometimes it's the guy in the contract, and then sometimes it's the old head of field service who didn't like me. And then sometimes it's the woman down at therapy who used to unload on me. It's never dad, though. It's always dad under different voices, roundabout.
It's kind of like, that reminds me of the idea of kind of the creation of a fault line. It's almost like, perhaps your dad creates the fault line, the initial trauma creates the fault line, mm-hmm. and then later experiences are what kind of rips the fault line open, so that what you hear when you experience the fault, when you experience the earthquake, is you hear the recent event rather than the thing which created the fault line a long time ago, earlier in your experience.
I see. So, but do you think that's the repressed experience? That's what you've actually repressed and you can't deal with directly?
Well, and that's
the voice of the critical voice of the father or the mother, or
well, one idea which has been popping up, or we've been talking about in the chat room periodically, has been Monty. Some people have, you know, or I forget her name, but there was maybe Mel got a lot of progress from Monty. And he says very clearly that TMS is not a deeply repressed emotions mm-hmm. condition. I think that's a very intriguing idea. I mean, it's possible. I know in my experience, so I am one of the many people who had that same critical father figure. I totally related to Mr. L, and I have a very strong inner critic. And I mean, I guess there's two approaches to that. One, you could, or sorry, when I hear the inner critic, I don't hear my father. Like I accept that my father and the death of my mother, probably I didn't have someone to soothe me, but my father maybe created that fault line. In my personal experience, I don't hear his voice in the fault mm-hmm. line. I've been beating myself up for so long, I really just hear my voice. Now, maybe that became my voice because of my father, but it feels rather than kind of like the causes may go way, way, way back, but much of the experience seems very rooted in the present for me, at least. Can anyone else relate to that?
Yeah, I relate to a lot of that. If I do anything, it seems like if I do anything that doesn't measure up to a certain amount of standards that I have for myself, mm-hmm. The voice is mine. But at the same time, I know where those voices are coming from. They're coming from people I used to work for. They're coming from parents that used to, you know, tell me certain things to do. And now I know where they're coming from. I thought I was just beating myself crazy at first when I started noticing the voices was there. You know, I just thought that was just part of who I was, and it is. It is. It's part of who we are. But at the same time, when I started figuring out where a lot of these voices were coming from, it was usually, you know, like authoritative figures that you look up to and people that you work for that you want to try to make a good impression on as you're growing up, as I was real young growing up, when I got my first jobs and so forth like that. And then I hear it. And it's still there. I can just guide them better now. I got a better management team going on up there now, as Enjoy said. I like that.
It seems, doesn't it, Eric, seem that having this knowledge of origins helps you deal better with diffusing the process of beating yourself up in the present, though? It isn't like... It seems like having that moment of insight, stripping away the veil and seeing where it all started, helps you deal with it more in the present. I don't doubt Monty's assertion that you have to deal with it in the here and now. Mm-hmm. Your self-esteem and so on, what's driving this TMS process. But I think it's very valuable knowing how it all started. You know, you figure out ends from beginnings. It isn't like you can go back and just have this big revelation about where it all came from and then TMS will stop. But that knowledge can give you a tool for
Correct.
Dealing with it now.
Which is such a fascinating and kind of complex picture of how the past relates to the present.
Oh, yeah. We're getting into philosophy 1A.
I think we also have to remember that that babies have an enormous ability to rage even before much of anything happens to them. You know, if you've ever had a newborn baby in the house and you don't, it decides that it's hungry, right? And you don't feed it instantly, you've got quite the little handful of rage on your hands. So I think we're born and, you know, our diaper needs changing or it's just lonesome or whatever. You know, you really have to pay attention to babies because they get really snarly really fast. And so I think we're born with that capacity to really profoundly dislike everything that isn't exactly the way we want it. And so, you know, we come up against the world, which, you know, frankly has very little interest in what we want. And of course we're going to have rage. Of course we're going
to
have rage.
Doesn't it have to do with the evolutionary survival motif, though? Because a baby is very afraid of being abandoned, because if it's abandoned, its needs aren't met. And we all share that fear of abandonment in situations that produce abandonment or smack of abandonment later on provoke that same infantile rage. But it's part of our survival mechanism, too.
Absolutely. We couldn't do without it. So we're not trying to get rid of the rage. We're not trying to get rid of the inner critic. We're not trying to get rid of any of it. What we're trying to do is manage it. Like, I've been looking at voice dialogue, which is kind of another similar part psychology. Hal and Sidra Stone from California, they've been around forever. And I really like the concept that they offer of developing an aware ego that kind of runs the show, right?
Okay.
Because then all these feelings, all that makes us who we are can be itself, but somebody with some rationality is in control. You know, it's not exactly in control in the sense that there's some kind of puppet master at all. You know, it's more like a group of people functioning with respect for everybody. Everybody gets heard, and we decide together what to do. But, you know, there's always a leader in every group. And that's what the Stones call the aware ego, who develops over time. They think that we don't have that in the beginning, but we gradually become more and more aware of who we are and what we are and how we function. Eventually, it becomes there's a oneness there. There's a unity, and isn't that what we're all looking for? Is not to be fragmented and fractured? And
it sounds like
Eric is so polite. I'm dying to hear what Eric was going to say.
Oh, well, at the end of the story, I think he came to the conclusion as Joy was just talking about, and as Bruce had mentioned. He doesn't have to be in the battle with himself anymore. He became aware of that. He became aware that he could allow himself to be more satisfied with himself. And I could have summed it up with just the word awareness, but at the same time, the way they put those two clauses together, that he didn't have to be in the battle with himself anymore. And that right there, it freed him up. At 60-something years old, it freed him up from that chatter or that talk in his head from his dad for all those years. And I'm sure, over the years, it had multiplied, the pressure had multiplied of the inner critic, had multiplied and made it real bad in his back or whatever. I think when he saw Sarno, it wasn't long and he had got to feeling better, correct? So Sarno made him feel better. Sarno soothed him. And then when he would go on vacation, he would be soothed. But then at the end, Dr. Sherman, correct?
Anderson.
Is this Sumner Anderson? Okay, I'm sorry.
Francis Sumner Anderson.
Okay, Dr. Francis Sumner Anderson. Okay, what she had done was allow him to come to an understanding of basically what Enjoy was just saying there about the, what was you calling that, Enjoy? Something awareness? It was like a higher awareness.
They call it ego. Excuse me, ego awareness.
Ego awareness. Okay.
Ego being, in their mind, the part of you that's the real you, your real self. Like some people might call it soul. Some people might call it all kinds of things. But then it becomes aware of the situation. Because what we're talking here about is, like, for example, Mr. L, he was unaware of what he was doing. right? As he became aware, he was able to orchestrate, manage his own life.
Awesome. But Bruce brings up some good topics that even now, even when we know that, you know, this inner critic can be controlled, it has still come back and slap you upside the head sometime. Am I not telling the truth? Guys, does your inner critic sometimes just get you down?
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes? Am I right, Bruce?
It does to me.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, I'm sitting alone at night and everything should be calm, mm-hmm. and suddenly there's this voice there saying, you're not good enough. You need to do more. You're faking it.
Yeah, I totally know what you're saying. And with that, go ahead.
Mr. L reports that having an intellectual understanding that TMS is caused by the reservoir of rage is not the most difficult part in his cure. The hard part is accepting that whatever the circumstances that you have brought you to this point, your TMS is in large part due to the idea that, quote, you are not happy with yourself and that you are not accepting of yourself, unquote. And that's the revelation that really, really helps Mr. L, that he's just plain not happy with himself due to this divided mind, this conflict he's having all his life with his dad, between the way he appears. He's adopted so many of his father's traits, that the hard, craggy experience, hard, craggy look, the penetrating eyes, the self-critic. He's just not being kind to himself.
Yes, mm-hmm. He wasn't accepting himself. He had all those voices from the dad, the internal critic. He had very high standards, and when he didn't get to meet them, he was so harsh on himself. Does that sound like somebody else on the phone? That sounds like me. But then again, now that I know what was going on with that chatter, with that inner critic, I like the way Enjoy puts it again. I can manage it. And by getting it under management, team management going on there, I began the healing process, you know?
Yeah, well, he did.
I didn't eliminate it now, you know, because it's there for a reason, correct? I mean, it's there to guide us, you know?
With Mr. L, it wasn't just chatter, though. It was like his whole body had become his dad and that inner critic.
Yeah.
The way his deportment, the way he handled himself, the way he intimidated people.
He even gave the doctor, Fran Sumner, that look, and she felt that in the story. And didn't she? That was what she meant.
She winced. Yeah.
And I'm like, wow, I have seen that look before myself. As I was reading the story, I had seen that look before. I'd probably given it a few times, you know. You know. Was you going to say something, Forrest?
Well, I was going to say that I was thinking we should probably wrap up because the chat room. So I was going to suggest that you could bring us to an end at some point.
Okay. Yeah. Well, again, it was a talk about Mr. L and the inner critic, and I'm sure we all got something from this. Everybody's got it, and the best thing to do is just do your best to soothe it, get it under control, let it know that you're in control, as Enjoy said. But at the same time, as Bruce and I and Forrest was talking, it's going to come up and it's going to be there sometime, and you have to just learn acceptance sometimes. But that's the discussion group for today. Next week at 2:00, we'll crank it back up and talk about some cool stuff again.